with a majority of 234 out of 435 seats, Republicans run the House of Representatives. But who runs the House Republicans? With us today, the House Majority Leader, Kevin McCarthy. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. By the time he was 21, Kevin McCarthy, a native of Bakersfield, had used $5,000 in lottery winnings to open a deli that became so successful he was able to sell it to the California State University in Bakersfield, his alma mater. In 2002, Mr. McCarthy was elected to the California Assembly, and before that session had ended, his fellow Republicans in the Assembly had elected him their floor leader. In 2006, Mr. McCarthy was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, where he was almost immediately appointed to the Republican Steering Committee. 2 years later, he was named chairman of the Republican Platform Committee. The next year, he was appointed House Chief Deputy Republican Whip. After the 2010 elections, he was elected House Majority Whip. And just a few weeks ago, only in his fourth term in the House, Mr. McCarthy was elected House Majority Leader, a position in which he is outranked in the House of Representatives only by the Speaker himself. In less than 8 years in the House, in other words, Kevin McCarthy has become one of the most important legislators in Washington and one of the most prominent Republicans in the nation. Congressman and Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Okay, civics lesson.
Yes.
People who got through high school have a rough idea what the Speaker of the House does, stands at that rostrum, controls what legislation comes to the floor for votes. What does the House leader do? What's your new job?
Well, the House leader responsibility is really running the floor. So the House leader works with all the committee chairs. So we work on the legislation and what's coming out. We schedule the floor, the House leader does. Then they work with the whip on...
The whip reports to you.
The whip reports to us about getting the votes for the bills to pass. So the most important thing is working with the committees and scheduling the floor.
What proportion of legislation actually gets to the floor for vote, roughly?
Well, there's so many bills announced. The way I like to do it, I like bills to have to go through committee and don't go around committee. I like regular order. But I'll give you a couple examples. You're not going to get 100% to go through. Things are worked and mixed. Sometimes you take a bill that are four bills and put into one. Currently, we have more than 350 bills that have passed the House that are just sitting in the Senate that won't get called up. Reid won't bring them up. But 98% of those bills have a bipartisan vote on them. That people on both sides of the House voted for those bills.
So I'm going here for analogies that to help me understand your basic job.
Yes.
Are you closer to the head football coach on the sideline calling the plays, or are you more like the manager in the dugout, the baseball manager, who goes in, who goes out, making small adjustments?
That's a good analogy. I've never heard the both. We want to empower the committee chairs. I'd say more like a baseball manager. Okay. You've got a lot of good players that can all play on the field and a lot of good players that are on the bench. And what you want to do, it's kind of like good to great. You want to get the right people on the bus, right? And so everybody has expertise. I mean, I believe the Senate is like being at a country club, and the House is like having breakfast at a truck stop, okay? We come from all different walks of life. We are a microcosm of society. Everybody has a different background, but everybody has a different expertise, right? And they may be on the right committee or not, but they still could have that expertise in it, and you want to utilize that for the whole conference, and you want the floor to be open. Like, I'll give you an example. In 2010, one of my jobs, I wrote the, in 94, we had the contract with America.
Right,
So we had what was called the Pledge to America. And in my time in the minority, no appropriation bills came to the floor and nobody could offer amendments. So we said, what would we like it to be different? So we open up, you have 12 appropriation bills. This is the funding of government. Anybody can offer any amendment. You don't have to go through rules committee or others. Sheila Jackson Lee, just in the appropriation process.
Democrats.
Sheila Democrat.
Jackson Lee.
Yes.
Very Democratic.
Who, philosophically, very different than I am.
Right.
I probably never voted for one of her amendments, but she was able to offer more amendments, like 50% more, than the entire Republican conference in the Senate for the last year, just in that 1 month. But a more open process, I think, makes it better. You may have the idea, but you should be challenged on the idea. Because to me, the philosophy should be the idea should win at the end of the day. And that should be the strength. Because when you walk into those chambers, these are the chambers that when Abraham Lincoln was president and you're debating the amendments, this is the floor. Civil rights, the day that will live in infamy. So regardless of party of what you're in, when you walk on that floor, you're an American first. And that's the challenge that should come forth.
David Firestone, writing in the New York Times this past spring, this is just before you were elected, Kevin McCarthy is running hard for majority leader, but except for the big office and the security detail and the power and the glory, it's hard to know why he really wants the job, close quote. You don't get paid more. Why do you want this job?
I always think it's better to serve when it's a chaotic time than when it's perfect. I want the job for one main reason. I want this country to be better. I want the opportunities. Look, I don't come from a family of Republicans. I don't come from a family of wealth. I even applied for a summer internship and got turned down, but I'm now sitting in the seat that I couldn't get an internship. That's only in America. I was able to start a business when I was 19. I don't believe the kids could do the same thing today. Every generation in this country has improved on the generation before it. But if you look at the latest Wall Street Journal poll, 3/4 of Americans believe their children won't have that same opportunity. So yeah, it's chaotic, it's tough in others. But you know, if there's 10 seconds to go, I want to have the ball and take the shot. I want the opportunity to make a difference. And so let's try it.
The House and the President, on July 30, the House votes a resolution to authorize the Speaker, your boss and friend, to bring a lawsuit against the Obama administration, one chamber of Congress suing the administration. This is an act without precedent in American history. What do you and the Speaker think you're doing?
I think what we're doing is when you think about the creation of this country, there were three co-equal branches. And everybody believed they were co-equal, not to protect the other branch, but protect us, protect the citizen. Now, does anybody in America today believe there are still three co-equal branches? Or do you have agencies today that legislate? Do you have a check and balance? And you know what? You can blame any different administration from driving that further. So this isn't about who sits in the office of the presidency. This is about the co-equal and making it come back there. I think the country is stronger in there. And what all you're saying is it gives Congress standing. It gives us standing because right now you don't. So if you have somebody, and look at what the Supreme Court has recently ruled, even unanimously on some of these decisions, if you have this out there, I think we could come back to the strength of this country of being co-equal.
Legal scholar and former Bush administration official John Yoo, quote, Congress can oppose Mr. Obama's refusal to enforce the law. Also, as I understand it, the resolution is voted largely because not so much that he refused to enforce the laws, that he remade the law with regard to Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Congress can oppose Mr. Obama by cutting off funding for his programs and blocking his appointments. Why don't you guys do that? Just defund him.
Well, I think
that's what the Constitution already permits you to do.
I think you've done some of those, but don't you remember what transpired earlier this year? Even though government supposedly shut down,
the debt ceiling,
98% was still going. It was a continuing resolution, actually, not on the debt ceiling. I think when I watch a president stand in the well and say, I'll use my phone and my pen to go around the Constitution, and people stand up and applaud, I don't care if that person's a Republican or Democrat. That's not the country what the Constitution says to do. So whether this person in the administration is Republican or Democrat, I think you need a check and balance. I believe that's why our forefathers created this. And I don't want the judicial system legislating. I don't want the executive branch. I think we all have our checks and balances. And I think that's the road of putting it back in order.
Do we know yet where the suit will be filed, which court the suit will be filed, and who will be the named defendants?
Don't know yet, but shortly you'll see.
Okay, stay tuned.
Yes.
Energy. Kevin McCarthy quoted in the Wall Street Journal this past June, mm-hmm. quote, energy is the issue I care most about, close quote. Why that issue?
I see it as our biggest future, okay? If you look, The challenge that we have today, I always think there's five things you have to do to make the next century ours. Energy is one of them. Because you've got to have, one, we're blessed of living in this country, but we have an abundant resource. Look at what the phenomenon that has gone on in America today. Do you know Texas has done more to change Mexico than anything? Texas now outproduces the entire country of Mexico. So what did Mexico
in,
do? Oil? Yes,
right, in oil. Okay.
And you, so you know what? Do you know what Mexico recently did? They changed their constitution.
Oh, that's right.
Because they're opening it up, a freer market. Airbus, we have Boeing, competes with Airbus, right? Do you know where Airbus just opened up a factory? In Alabama. You know why? Because of the energy cost. When we think about manufacturing jobs, think about this. If we could change and have tax reform, and we have low energy costs, what would happen? First off, you'd have more manufacturing in America because you'd want to build the product here, value added, and sell it. We're in a competitive world. Also think of this. Watch about what's happening in the world today and in Ukraine. What could America do for Europe to change the chokehold that Putin has on it? Wouldn't we free up the idea of freedom in other places? And if you look at job creation, in North Dakota, they're now producing 1 million barrels a day. They didn't start till 2006. The technology that has changed, the technology that has changed, right? If you go to North Dakota and you want to get a job at, let's say, McDonald's, you get a $1,000 signing bonus. There's no foreclosed homes there, right? They have the lowest tax and they have a surplus. I see a job creation that could transform this country, but at the same place, I see the value added. You look at the valley that we're in right here. If you have low energy costs, technology boom will continue to grow here to be able to manufacture. It wouldn't be that we're going to manufacture in China. We would want to manufacture here.
Okay, question then. Since the 1970s, there's been a ban on exporting crude oil from this country. That ban is starting to get to break down this lawsuit, that lawsuit, but still you're on record as opposing lifting that ban. You've changed your position.
No, I never changed my position. The question was asked of me, and maybe I understood the question wrong. I thought the question was asked of me, what did I think Congress could pass at that moment?
Oh, I see.
And so what I took it as, and so I was using it as a whip position. I said, well, LNG would pass right now, what's going on. But I think if you went to crude, I think that would be tougher. Now, I was giving it not from my perspective, but what I saw Congress. Now, I'm a free marketer. And it's not that the discussion should be about crude. We don't sell crude. We refine crude. And what do we refine it into? Gasoline. Now, gasoline is sold everywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why wouldn't we do the same with crude? Because that's what it is. The question what people ask are wrong. They took an approach in the 70s, and that was a protectionist.
Right.
If we open this up, just as we've seen this boom continue to grow and expand year over year. I mean, we're outproducing than we've ever have in America. We would even grow further. In natural gas, we've slowed down. When we had that peak, we went and discovered more. Now they stopped because the price got too low.
There are big gas fields.
Yes.
Under coastal California and off in the Channel Islands.
Yes.
You want to frack here at home, here in California?
Do I want to frack in California? We frack in California, yes. Do people understand what fracking is and how it's been around for 40 years? I want the protections.
Do they frack in Bakersfield? That's old-fashioned derricks that are going up and down in the ground in your district. Isn't that right?
Yeah, but that's not what fracking is.
No, I know. But
if you go and frack, you frack for 1 day or 1 week. All it does is open up the shell with inside, right? And it's a new technology. You're down a mile and a half. You're out over into a mile and a half. You want to make sure you're protected. Show me a place that has caused a problem. If the right environmental protections, yes, you can do it. In the fields of Kern County, they're more than 100 years old. It's a thicker velocity when it comes to the oil. We steam it.
Right.
But the idea of the Monterey Shale is one of the largest finds that if we ban it, what would happen? And let me ask you this.
I want to take that 90 seconds and send it to every environmentalist in California, there would be cardiac arrests up and down the state. Congressman, it's a dangerous procedure. There's some evidence that it causes seismic activity, fracking. It's an overuse of water. Here we are in a drought.
Overuse of water?
Yeah, because you have to pump huge amounts of water. I'm just giving you the environmentalist argument. You really want to start this
when
fight
you
in
drill,
California?
You add. Start the fight. I want to turn California around. Okay? California used to be the second and third largest producer. They're not so much. And what do? You pay the tax to the city, you pay the tax to the school district, you pay the tax to the county. We have one of the biggest. Now, let me ask you this. If you don't discover in America, who are you going to pay for it? You're going to pay somebody else. Are they environmentally sound as we're doing it? No. Do they have the same philosophical beliefs of freedom and human rights that we do? No. Are you funding those jobs at a different benefit? And who are they funding to attack our way of life? You have to think of this. You can have environmental protections and at the same time produce something that produces jobs in others.
You're going to have to go door to door in Malibu to make that argument. The New York Times, quote, "It is not unusual for Washington lawmakers to take an interest in affairs back home, but few match Mr. McCarthy's fascination in the details of issues confronting his state of California. The bullet train, the high-speed train, that Governor Brown is determined."
That's an oxymoron because it's not high speed and it's not a bullet.
Okay, hold that. "Governor Brown is determined to build this from San Francisco to Los Angeles. You're just determined to oppose it. How come?"
Well, I'm opposed to it because when it was on the ballot, it said it'd be $33 billion.
Now to 68.
Billion. Yeah, they moved it back from 98. And when you proposed it to the American, to the Californian voters, I don't believe you're honest to what it is today, and you should have to go back to the voters because it's not high speed. They changed it. It's going to go on existing track. Don't take my words for it. I have a good friend, Elon Musk. Elon Musk is a very smart man.
Very smart guy, yes.
SpaceX, Tesla, and others. He's opposed to it because he says, why would we, in a world of Silicon Valley, a state that changes the world, build something that's slow? And why would you do it the most expensive per mile than anywhere else in the world? I don't believe it'll ever exist. It said it would have outside funding, which you have not gotten in. They look at the federal government to pay for it. We're in a deficit. Then if you look at the ridership, you're going to have to subsidize. And when California decides that they're going to build this and they're going to subsidize the riders, where does that money come from? It comes from our schools. It comes from our services. And then I'm sitting and looking at which we have known the whole time we lived in California, whiskeys for drinking, waters for fighting. We have not put the infrastructure in for the greater resources of water, and we're being punished today by it. Why don't we change course and say, what would be the best use of this money? I think infrastructure and water would be a much better use longer term, and build an investment. If the governor wants a legacy, that's a much stronger legacy.
Leader. The governor sat down in the offices of the Wall Street Journal just a few days ago, and he said, quote, now he's arranged to go ahead and build this train without your stinking federal money.
He's going to
get it from the state, he says. Quote, "We would like more federal help, but right now the Republicans under Mr. McCarthy have decided it's better to treat high-speed rail as a political football than a great civic opportunity." Close quote.
I think any investment, if we're elected, we have a responsibility to the hardworking taxpayer. And it's not just me and it's not just Republicans. You could go to the Democrats that even chaired the Transportation Committee that now opposed to it. The business plan doesn't work. And if you walk through his business plan, he still needs $55 billion more. Where in the election did it say the federal government would pay for this?
You'll see to it that the federal government doesn't.
We're $17 trillion. It's not high-speed rail. I don't believe it can be successful, and I don't believe it's the best use of tax dollars' money, so I would not support it.
Drought here in California. It's getting serious now. People are
having... It's beyond serious.
Beyond serious. And, well, in the Central Valley, of course, your farmers, there's a lot of land lying fallow. There are a lot of people who are out of jobs, agricultural workers who are out of jobs. To what extent is this an act of God, and to what extent is it an act of the Environmental Protection Agency and the Democrats who run this state? What could you fix by changing policy?
Well, let me give you one short example. 3 years ago, we had 170% of snowpack.
Just 3 years ago.
Just 3 years ago. And you have two systems, right? The snowpack comes to the north. You have to move it down. We grow in the central, and the population's mainly in the south.
Right.
So you have a state project and a federal project. In the year that you had 170% of snowpack, you only got 70% of the water. But people still paid for 100%. You have to move through the delta that has environmental issues, but you have a court case that picks fish over people. So it's 8-1. Even when we had a rain
eight
this
year. 8-1. What's the ratio? What do you mean?
8-1. So you would go through, a gallon comes through, they're going to run it through the delta, out into the ocean, 8 for every one that they're going to bring down. Because they made that decision in the rain recently, so we lost that. Where does that water go out to the ocean? So what you'd want to do, like anything else, plan for a rainy day, in essence. Why don't we have greater storage? Population continues to grow in California. We have 12% of the nation's population, but we haven't built, and why? Because you get stopped. Someone environmentally, somebody in a court case, stops the expansion of storage of water. Alameda stores their water in Kern County, right? You bank it, we bank it in the ground. But when you have less than 10% water flow, you can't do reverse flow, so you couldn't even get your water out. Why don't we make our investment now? To me, environmentally has held us back, court cases have held us back, and as Californians ourselves, we have not planned for the future. We have been stopped many times that we've tried to do this.
So if Jerry Brown wants a legacy like his dad's, Pat Brown built the aqueduct.
We're still living off it. What was the population then and the population today?
Well, the population of when Pat Brown was governor is about 12 or 15, about half.
39 to 40 million now?
Right. Okay. New York Times columnist, I'm still on California because this animates you. You care about this state. New York Times columnist, you're fourth generation Californian?
Born and raised, can't get elected anywhere else.
Paul Krugman in the New York Times, again, just a few days ago, quote, in 2012, Democratic dominance finally became strong enough to overcome the paralysis in California, and Governor Jerry Brown was able to push through a modestly liberal agenda of higher taxes, spending increases, and a rise in the minimum wage. California also moved enthusiastically to implement Obamacare, all things that Leader McCarthy opposed.
Yes.
Paul Krugman continues, there is no sign of catastrophe. Employment in the state is up. California's cut the number of residents
GDP is down.
Health insurance in half. I'm giving you the argument. The budget is officially back in surplus. Paul Krugman once again, quote, California's success is a demonstration that the extremist ideology, that's you, Buster, still dominating much of American politics is nonsense, close quote.
I can't.
Jerry Brown's running things, the Democrats are running things, and the state's doing pretty well.
I can't wait till history writes it. Okay, state's doing pretty well. You and I just talked, we said we had 39 million people.
Right.
That's 12% of the nation's population.
Yes, it is.
What percentage of the nation's welfare population do we have? 32%. We now get 25% of our entire budget from 144,000 people out of 39 million. You pay a 13% state. So you're paying more than half your money into the federal government. So what are the ramifications of this? Does it happen overnight? No. They go retroactive on their tax. So they have their money today, but can they plan for the future? Water is one of the biggest crises we have. The governor just said the water bond has to be less because he can't go out to sell it. Because he'll go out of a balance because the payments. So the biggest crisis he can't solve. Toyota just made an announcement that they're leaving. And what did the governor—
Where are they going, Texas?
Texas.
Texas.
And what did the governor say? Well, smart people could find a way to stay here. No, you can't. Structure dictates behavior. And the structure of California, people will move. Tiger Woods grew up in California, learned to play golf here. But when he went pro, where did he move to?
Florida. No income tax.
Exactly.
Okay.
So history will show they were wrong, and history will show it was detrimental to California in the long run. We are the eighth largest economy. We used to be the sixth. Our GDP is not growing. Compare that to Texas. Chuck Schwab, he's having to move people to Texas. You look at all the movement based upon because it's becomes a real difference. Before it was a wealth movement out, now it's
rich
my
people.
Now it's my neighbor down the street, a small business owner. That 13% makes the difference of profit or not.
Okay, Leader McCarthy, you just, as you've written down here, California, 12% of the nation's population, This is, we come back to the country now. You are intent, you've said so again and again, on building the Republican Party.
Yes.
You want a majority. This state is now white minority. As recently as the census of 1970, yeah, it was 90% white. California, Ronald Reagan's California, the California that elected Ronald Reagan governor twice, was essentially Iowa on the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That California's gone. Either you find a way to appeal to Hispanics, or the biggest state in the nation will be permanently written off in the presidential and senatorial races and gubernatorial race to the other side, to the Democrats. Either you find a way to appeal to Hispanics, or the same thing will begin to happen in Texas, and the Republican Party will become a permanent minority party. Either you find a way to appeal to Hispanics, or your own seat is in danger, because although the voting age population of the 23rd congressional district is now 20% or so, the total Hispanic population in your district is 35%. It's kids. They're going to grow up and become
37.
37?
Yeah.
Okay, leave it to you to be up on the stats. So what do you do?
It's not just Hispanics if you want to grow the Republican Party.
All right.
It's everyone. It's the Asian population as well. If you look at the vote for president, Asians voted more for Barack Obama than even Hispanic by 2 points, 72%. I think a couple different things have to happen. This party has to be a party that's inclusive, that everybody is welcome to join, and people want to come. It's also a party based upon policy. And you know what I believe? I don't believe in going and saying, oh, I'm just going to reach you just because of the color of your skin. I want to reach you on the ideas of the opportunity for your children. Listen, when my wife Judy and I, we have two kids, Connor and Megan, mm-hmm, 20 and 18. Mm-hmm. It's no longer the goal of what we become. It's what the opportunity our children will have. That's like anywhere else. And if you look at the education system in California, and you want to reach people of all races, what's the biggest equalizer? Education.
Right.
You want your children to be able to have a better. And I believe the system that the Democrats have perpetuated here has only shrunk us. Why are there 1 million kids in America today on a waiting list for a charter school? And they're not our kids, right? They're kids from every different walk of life, but more economically. Why don't we lift everybody and give them an opportunity? Then why don't we talk about entrepreneurship? Everybody wants to have a chance to move up, but you want everybody to have it. So it's not based upon what somebody's color of their skin is, based upon an idea that we could sell more. And I'm the first one to tell you, I'm a happy conservative, mm-hmm, right? I'm not there to tell you.
We can see that.
I believe in less government, but I don't believe in no government. I believe in an efficient, effective government. But I also believe in expanding, and why I'm happy, I know these policies give someone greater freedom and greater liberty. And I believe, even from the standpoint, if you look into my office, I got this great big portrait of Abraham Lincoln and Ronald Reagan. You ever wonder what advice they'd give us today? Lincoln would say the first bit of advice, believe in the exceptionalism of this country. Think of Gettysburg. You all know 47 years ago today, mm-hmm, but you ever listen to the other words? Our forefathers brought forth a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated that all men are created equal. But if we fail, government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall perish from earth. Not that France or England would do it. Now, Abraham Lincoln was the very first Republican president. He grasped the idea that we're different than others, created in liberty, and all men and women are created equal. I think if we hone to those philosophies,
it'll work.
We will
for
expand
the Republican
further.
Party. Okay. 2010, I guess it was 29 actually, you and Eric Cantor and Paul Ryan formed
the Young Guns
to recruit candidates for the House of Representatives, Republican candidates. And you did a good job. And you took back the majority in the elections of 2010. So you know something about recruiting.
Yes.
Of your 234 members today, zero African Americans, aside from Eric Cantor, who will be stepping down at the end of this Congress, zero Jews, seven Hispanics, 19 women.
Mm-hmm.
So you've just said that by remaining faithful to the policies of Abraham Lincoln and mm-hmm Ronald Reagan, the Republican Party can expand its reach.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to be able to recruit more Hispanics?
Oh, yes.
Now let's go back. You took a statistic and in a time and place, and you rated them differently. If you rated in the 2010 election, you wouldn't say there were no African Americans. The difference was Tim Scott, who we went in South Carolina, not only became a congressman, but he was the only African American in the U.S. Senate, and he was Republican.
You lost him to the Senate.
So there's nothing wrong with people being promoted even higher.
Right.
Now, the whole way we became Young Guns was Fred Barnes, the Weekly Standard. He dubbed that and put us on the cover. Eric was the leader, Paul was the thinker, I was the strategist. I believed in analyzing different metrics for how a minority becomes a majority, right? And there are metrics out there, from the number of candidates down to an odd metric, you have to have one former professional athlete, from 94 to 2006. I recruited more candidates than ever before. I recruited more women than ever before. Sometimes it's difficult.
Democrats like government, by and large, right? So you'd say to yourself, I mean, this is sort of standard. You learn this in Political Science 101 at a place like Stanford. Pretty easy to recruit Democrats. They're a school teacher, a social worker, or the Lutheran pastor. They all want to do good, and so that's easy to recruit Democratic. Republicans, by and large, champion the private sector. The really talented Republicans are out in the private sector building careers. Mm-hmm. What do you say to someone you want to become a Republican candidate? You're going to say, mess up your life for 9 months campaigning, and if you win, you get a cut in pay, and you get to leave your family here in Iowa or Kansas or the Central Valley of California and then fly back and forth to Washington. How do you do that? How do you recruit somebody to become one of your candidates?
I did it differently. I don't think Washington should decide. And I never would talk somebody into running. You know what I'd ask them? Why do you want to run? And I'll give you this one story that I think symbolized all 2010. I was on the road early, and you got to understand where we were. Barack Obama had almost a 70% approval rating. NRCC didn't have any money, so I was spending our own dime going out there. And I rented a car, and I forgot the Garmin, so I was in Illinois because it's the earliest primary. I was supposed to be in Iowa, but I was in Wisconsin, took a wrong turn, went all through Iowa. And then I went to North Carolina, then I was coming back to Tennessee. So I go in and I sit at a table, and this guy walks up and he goes, Mr. Kevin, I'm Stephen Fincher and I'm from Frog Jump, Tennessee. I don't know what Frog Jump, Tennessee, but I asked Stephen Fincher this question. Because if you don't have the fire in the belly, you're not going to win anyways. I said, why do you want to run? And Stephen Fincher said, well, I'm a farmer and I'm watching a country change before my eyes. And I don't know how I tell my children I do nothing. I said, Stephen, that's a great answer. He goes, oh, Kevin, I don't know if I'd be the best candidate. I said, why is that, Stephen? He said, I've never been elected to anything before. I said, that's all right. It's an anti-incumbent year. He said, oh, Mr. Kevin, I've never been to Washington, D.C. on vacation. I said, Stephen, as of right now, you're my top recruit in the nation. And I went back to Washington, right, to our conference. I said, I just found the individual who's going to define this election. And the elite media made fun of me. Somebody from Frog Jump, Tennessee, right? Well, you know what happened? That incumbent ended up quitting because he saw a poll he's going to lose. Two other people got in the race, even in the primary, and wrote themselves a $2 million check and a $3 million check. Stephen Fincher won. Stephen Fincher's a congressman. Last year when we passed the Jobs Act that was signed into law, that Stephen Case said is one of the greatest bills that helped rejuvenate the economy, you know who was the author of that? Stephen Fincher.
The man from Frog Jump.
Yes. That's what the difference is. You go to him, and it was the compassion. It wasn't so much about party. It was about the country. That they were willing to risk it all for something greater than themselves. And I think there comes a time and place in every generation that you got to have that fight. And I think we're at that point. There's a frustration out there. There's a frustration that you've got bills that have passed the House, but one man in the Senate, Harry Reid, can stop all that. And that's not me saying this. You can take Chris Murphy, a Democrat senator. You know what he said recently? Connecticut.
Right.
You know what he said? He said he had more influence in the minority in the House than in the majority in the Senate. That
that Harry Reid has stymied all this. How can you have more than 350 bills that 98% of them have a bipartisan vote to them, and he won't even bring them up?
We've been talking about appeal and broadening the appeal
yes.
of the Republican Party, particularly Hispanics. How can the Republican Party make the case for stronger border controls? This is immigration.
Yes.
While continuing to appeal to Hispanics. And in particular, if you can just, we've got a crisis on the border. The president asked for $4 billion in assistance. The Senate didn't pass something like 2.7.
No, the Senate didn't pass anything.
The Senate.
Senate went home and Senate couldn't pass anything.
So the Speaker asked the House for 2.7, looked as though your members weren't going to accept that. He put, forward 615. Anyway, nothing's happened.
No, it has.
Oh, it has?
See, okay. This is the difference. Okay. If you watch in history, my first day of leader, the Senate didn't do anything and went home. Right. I went to the microphones. And Steny Hoyer wanted to know what was going to go on. I told him, you know what? We're not going to leave. We're going to try to get something done, so be prepared for later votes. And they boo me from the standpoint. But this is, okay, the number one issue in America today is the border. I believe in small, limited government. But one cool government should be able to do is secure their border. Right now, it's a major crisis. A couple reasons why. In 2008, a bill was passed, wasn't voted on, passed by UC, unanimous consent, that dealt with human trafficking. That what it said was you would deal with kids and people from contiguous countries, that's Canada and Mexico, different than you deal with anybody else. Well, nothing happened in 2009, nothing happened in 2010, nothing happened in 2011, not until the president changed by executive order DACA. Now it's only—
DACA is the deferred action—
Yeah.
Okay.
So now there's three countries in Central America that these kids are all coming from because they believe they pay these individuals that they call coyotes $7,000, give the cherishment of their children to come to America. The president goes to Texas for a fundraiser but doesn't have time to see the border. The president also had made executive order or Antiquities Act a new national monument in New Mexico on the border. You know what he wrote in there? Border Patrol cannot use motorized vehicles. So you can't be 21st century. You could go back to the 19th century. So you can watch along the border people going in here. Look, we are a land of immigrants, but we're also rule of law. The first thing you have to do before you can get any immigration reform is secure the border. So what we did, we passed a bill that dealt with making sure the kids are treated humanely. We've met with the three presidents from the countries. You know the number one thing they told me? We want our children back. We want to unite them with their family.
Guatemala, Honduras, and
El Salvador.
El Salvador.
So what we did was we allowed the states to bring up National Guards, care for the kids, put the Border Patrol back there, make sure they had the money, make sure they had the resources for the children, change the national monument as well, and actually let those children unite with their families. What's more important than that? We acted. You know what the Senate did? They're home right now. The president should call them back up. What did our forefathers create?
Was there any money in that bill?
Yes, okay. $695 million.
So that's in the Senate right now.
Yes, and that goes all the way to the end of September because that's our budget year. So there's plenty of money in there to deal with the problem. But Harry Reid sent everybody back home. The forefathers said the Senate should pass a bill, the House should pass a bill. If they're different, they should go to conference. We've done our job. They went home without even doing their job.
A couple last questions here.
Sure.
A decade ago, you would have had very powerful committee chairman helping yes. to hold the caucus in line. You would have had a seniority system, strong seniority system, which created incentives for the junior members to behave and stay in line. You would have had earmarks, so if anybody needed a bridge built back in his district, the leader could have arranged for the earmark to be inserted into the correct piece of legislation. And furthermore, you would have had members who moved their families to Washington and saw each other at Little League games over the weekend or ran into each other at the church or the synagogue over the weekend, you would have had an easier time establishing a sense of community. Now you're in session Tuesday to Thursday. Everybody, including the leader, gets on an airplane.
No, we're Monday to Thursday or Tuesday to Friday.
Okay. I'm a little bit off, but the larger
yes.
point. And today you don't have any of that. What tools do you have to hold your caucus together?
But you also had other things. You had proxy voting. So it didn't matter if anybody showed up in committee. Ross Gonkowski would sit there as one Democrat all the minority could show up and he could throw all his votes down and say it's over. So did you get good government out of that? What you have is the power of the idea. The idea that one person could put in and buy off from an earmark, is that good government? We have greater transparency. I think Congress is a microcosm of society. We've got a lot of challenges in here. But remember what Winston Churchill said. You can always count on Americans to do what's right after they exhausted every other option.
Last question, prediction. You have 234 members today.
Yes.
Over in the Senate, that country club on the other side of the building, there are 45 Republicans. When the next Congress is sworn in January, how many members will you have in your caucus?
I think we'll gain somewhere between 2 to 12. I think we could end up at 245.
Got it.
I think there's an 80% chance that the Senate flips. There are seven seats that Democrats currently hold that are up for re-election that Romney carried, six of them by double digit. But what you really want to watch is the expansion of it, okay? Cory Gardner in Colorado. This is a blue state, but I think Cory wins. Washington State, New Hampshire, Michigan, Virginia. These are blue, but they're going to
play. Scott Brown has a chance in New Hampshire?
Oh, yes. Now, remember this. In 2010, when I was a recruitment chair, Barney Frank, we had no seats in Massachusetts. Barney Frank was chairman of financial service during the most difficult time of financial services, right? He had to borrow $250,000 from his bank for his own seat. When you expand the playing field, when the country wakes up, that's a difference. I'm watching polls today that are stronger than they were in 2010 because the American public is frustrated. Historically, the party in power, meaning who's in the White House,
right,
loses seats during this third cycle. Bill Clinton was different. I think when you look at the president's polling numbers, when you look at the frustration, when you look at Obamacare, what has transpired, the frustration, if you have your health care, you can keep it, your deductible's higher. When you look at what's happening in the country, there becomes this malaise. So there's a combination. I'm not saying this is going to be 2010, but this is going to be a little like 1980, that you feel the country is not where it used to be.
Okay, last question. I'm going to give you your prediction. You pick up, you go to 240. The Senate is now 51 Republicans. You and the Speaker on one side of the chamber and Mitch McConnell, I'm going to assume you believe he'll win. Mm-hmm. Mitch McConnell on the other side of that building. You have 2 years before the presidential election. You will have captured control of the Congress, and Barack Obama will be in his last 2 years as president. Give me one thing that you believe you can actually get done in those 2 years.
I think this. What we need to get done. Tax reform.
You can get something to the White House that he'll sign?
We can get something to the White House. I'm not going to be in his mind. But the difference today is nothing gets to his desk, so he's protected by not having to make a decision.
You can put
you
him
look
in
at
spot.
What's going on in inversions. You look at repatriation. How can you sit there and argue that we don't need tax reform? He has said it. Put it on his desk. National energy policy. We've almost already passed one out of the House. Get it to his desk. I would say when you look at the restructuring, reforming of these agencies. These agencies are now legislating, becoming too powerful. They want to eliminate risk instead of grow. Too much duplication.
So you will pass a reform agenda.
Yes.
And put bill after bill after bill on his desk and let him worry about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's your job.
Kevin McCarthy, Majority Leader of the United States House of Representatives, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
For the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson. We'll be right back.